Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to author Stephanie Whittles Wax, who has a new memoir about the life and death of her brother, comedian Harris Whittles. Stephanie also continues the conversation backstage just for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
It's been almost 2 weeks since the horrific shootings in Parkland, Florida, and the Never Again movement, started by students at Stoneman Douglas High School, continues to intensify, putting more and more pressure on Republicans in the NRA. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. President Trump's approval ratings have fallen back down to historically low levels amid an avalanche of scandal and chaos in his administration. And yet, on Friday, Trump went to the Conservative Political Action Conference and made this outlandish claim about all the promises he's made that he supposedly kept.
Remember this. We've gotten, you know, somebody got on television recently and they said, actually, this is the first time I can remember. Trump made campaign promises. He may be the only person that actually fulfilled more promises than he made. I think that's true.
Oh, my God. What is he talking about? Trump is so garbled, his speeches are becoming logical paradoxes. I fulfilled promises I haven't even made. I married a woman I haven't met, and I made a rock so heavy, I can't lift it. So Trump claims he heard someone on television make that claim, and he's just repeating it. And I think he must have gotten it from this guy a few weeks ago.
I was there 4 months, you know this, Paul, and they were saying he didn't fulfill a promise. But now we've fulfilled far more promises than we promised.
Does Trump think that the Trump on TV is a different guy?
He's back. He's on TV again. Oh, I like the cut of his jib. I'm going to copy his haircut.
Of course, the immediate crisis facing Trump and the rest of the government right now is our country's epidemic of gun violence. The national conversation over gun safety has only intensified in the days since the Parkland shooting, and people are demanding action. And in response to those demands, Trump has spent the last week or so rambling nonsensically about his truly deranged idea to arm teachers. And today he took that rambling one step further, insisting that he personally would have run into the school to confront the shooter, whether he was armed or not.
You know, I really believe, you don't know until you test it, but I think I really believe I'd run in there even if I didn't have a weapon.
Nothing about that is believable. Forget running into a school to confront a shooter. I don't believe you'd run anywhere, period. You can't even be bothered to walk down a flight of stairs. Then again, I said before that I didn't think you'd run, and man, did I get burned. There's really nothing worse than a fake tough guy. Trump lives in a fantasy world where he's some sort of action movie star who'd rush into danger and save the day. I'm sorry, but you're not exactly Liam Neeson. If you'd been in the movie Taken, they would have had to change the name.
All right, so you have her? Okay. Okay, thanks for the call.
But it kept getting worse because Trump lashed out at the media, accurately describing his plan to arm teachers as a plan to arm teachers, insisting that he would only give guns to teachers who knew how to use them.
When the press covered it, the headline was, Trump wants all teachers to have guns. Trump wants teachers to have guns. I don't want teachers to have guns.
I want highly trained people that have a natural talent, like hitting a baseball or hitting a golf ball or putting. How come some people always make the four-footer and some people under pressure can't even take their club back, right?
Well, even when he's laying out his plan to prevent school shootings, he can't hide how much he'd rather be playing golf. Also, the only people who ask how come some people always make the four-footer are the people who never make the four-footer. When Trump putts, I bet he makes Eric lie down on the green to try and blow his ball into the hole. Father, I'm running out of air. Of course, the only reason we're still talking about the issue of gun violence is because of the students at Stoneman Douglas High School who have demanded action and sparked a national movement for gun reform. Their passionate calls for action have disrupted the usual routine that seems to unfold after every mass shooting. And for that, they've been subjected to deranged attacks on everything from their maturity to their credibility to their tone. Like Stoneman Douglas student Sarah Chadwick, who was scolded by conservatives when she tweeted, "We should change the names of AR-15s to Marco Rubio because they are so easy to buy." Damn. That is a white hot burn. There's only one thing to do when you get burned that hard, Marco. Yeah, drink up. After that tweet, Fox News host Laura Ingraham quoted Chadwick's line on Twitter and added how teens speak to and about adults, calling her Stoneman Douglas sophomore Sarah Chadwick, which prompted this response from Chadwick. "I'm a junior." Laura Ingraham, what is wrong with you? Don't go after teenagers on social media. You saw what happened to Marco Rubio. So in short, Marco Rubio might be easy to buy, but Laura Ingraham is easy to own. No. And then there are those who have spent the last 2 weeks lecturing students on their maturity and their qualifications for talking about gun reform and claiming their movement is somehow being hijacked by left-wing groups.
The media's focused more on a teenager's expertise in supply-side control measures for guns, which, Tucker, let's be candid, they probably have not studied a very complicated, layered issue.
Their sorrow can very easily be hijacked by left-wing groups
but do you think
who
it
have
has
an agenda. Well, let's ask ourselves, do we really think that, and I say this sincerely, do we really think 17-year-olds on their own are going to plan a nationwide rally?
You don't think 17-year-olds can plan a rally? 17-year-olds know how to plan things. When you're 17, you're too young to do most things, so you have to find ways around it. You got to get fake IDs, coordinate alibis, figure out how to make a bong out of an apple, an inhaler, and a straw. You gotta bring scope with you so you can wash away the smell of alcohol, but then your parents smell a ton of scope and they knew you were drinking, but they're also a little impressed you remember to bring scope. The attacks on these students are clear evidence that the movement is working. The NRA and their supporters are scared, and now the NRA and their allies are resorting to increasingly ludicrous suggestions for how to deal with gun violence in schools. Trump, for example, spent the weekend repeating his deranged idea for giving guns to teachers in his CPAC speech and then again in the interview with Fox News.
We would have had some great teachers that were gun adept, meaning, you know, really understood weaponry and guns, and if they had concealed permits, you wouldn't have this problem today.
This is one of the worst things about having Trump as president. Every time he goes on TV and blurts the dumbest things in the world, the rest of us have to debate it like it's a real idea. He says, hey, I think we should take incredibly stressed out people who make $30,000 a year and give them guns. And then Wolf Blitzer has to stand there and go, well, let's ask the panel. He said it, so now I gotta ask you all. You have to give me answers like it's a real thing. Now, there's no evidence that anywhere close to 10 to 20% of teachers have firearms training, as Trump claims, nor is there any evidence that would actually prevent school shootings. Second, there's the question of how teachers themselves feel about this idea. And in the days since Trump floated it, the response from teachers, including those from Stoneman Douglas, have been a resounding no thanks.
You heard the president today. He, in effect, wants people like you to be on the front lines, to be armed, if you have the aptitude for it, as aptitude as he described it. Is that a good idea?
No, I have no desire to own a gun, carry a gun, shoot a gun, touch a gun. And the president said that those of us who would be willing to be armed would get some kind of a bonus. I'm not even given adequate money to buy supplies for my classroom, But now if I choose to carry a gun will be provided for me and I will be given a bonus.
Now, I know we didn't get to him in the clip, but just in case you're curious, the guy on the right's pro-gun. Yeah, I know. I know you're all watching the clip. You're like, hey, what's the guy in the super clean cowboy hat thing? Very pro-gun. But seriously, the teacher is right. Teachers need supplies, not guns. The only guns that should be in schools are glue guns. And they should be used the way all students use them, to glue the shop teacher's butt to his chair. And when they're not calling for more guns in schools, gun supporters are complaining that it's actually video games and movies that are causing violence, as Trump did last week.
I'm hearing more and more people say the level of violence on video games is really shaping young people's thoughts. And then you go the further step, and that's the movies. You see these movies, they're so violent, and yet a kid is able to see the movie if sex isn't involved, but killing is involved, and maybe they have to put a rating system for that.
Does Trump not know that movies already have a rating system? I love how he's always trying to suggest things that already exist. Movies should have a rating system, and on top of that, you should have to buy a ticket. I think we can all agree. And they should have a concession stand where they sell some sort of snack made from popped corn. You could call it corn pop. But you know what? Trump is right. People are way too influenced by movies. Just take this guy as an example.
In fact, I have a license to carry in New York. Can you believe that? Nobody knows that. What was the famous movie? Remember? No, remember? Where he went around and he sort of, after his wife was hurt so badly and killed. What? Charles Bronson, right? The late, great Charles Bronson. Name of the movie? Come on. Death Wish. Remember that? Oh, we're going to cut you up, sir. We're going to cut you up. Oh, oh, oh. Bing. One of the great movies. But could you imagine with Trump, somebody says, oh, all these big monsters aren't around. He's easy pickings, and then,
And you think 17-year-olds are too immature to discuss gun control? He's literally making gun sound effects. And the wrong ones. Beak, boink, woof, 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 woof. Commentators on the right have spent the day since the Parkland shooting insisting that teenagers are somehow too immature to comment on an issue like gun reform, when in reality, the only people who sound like children are the ones using phrases like good guys and bad guys and pretending that all you need to do to stop a school shooting is have someone there to run in and go,
bink.
This has been a closer look. Our guest is a writer whose new memoir, Everything is Horrible and Wonderful, a tragicomic memoir of genius, heroin, love, and loss, available now. Please welcome to the show Stephanie Wittles-Wax, everyone. Thanks for being here, Stephanie.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I knew your brother a little bit. I was a big fan of his. Met him a couple times. But for those who don't know, he was an incredibly talented comedian and writer who overdosed at the age of 30, a heroin overdose. What would you want people to know in both now and in the book about your brother Harris?
Well, first and foremost, Harris was a comedian and a human being who all the comedians that we all love think was the funniest.
Yeah.
So he's the first place. Everyone else is second.
That was what I remember.
Sorry. Yeah.
That's all right. No, hey.
You can't ever be first.
Look, a lot of people like silver medals. Yeah.
Yeah. They're good.
They're good medals.
There's a place for those.
Yeah.
He was also this magical boy wonder human being who at 22 was discovered by Sarah Silverman at an open mic. He got onto her show. He went on to Parks and Recreation. If you've heard the word humble brag, that's his handiwork.
He came up with that.
He came up with it. I see it everywhere now. He's never credited, so I feel like he's really arrived.
Your parents would take you to see comedians when you're really young, maybe age inappropriate times.
Absolutely. We never should have been where we were. Uh-huh. we went to see, we lived in Houston and there was a club called The Laugh Stop. I don't know if you're familiar.
No, I've never been, no.
But they had great people come through. We saw Mitch Hedberg there. We saw, Louis C.K. Harris went up actually after his set. Harris was 13 and gave him notes.
Louis C.K.
Yeah. So very fearless.
Yeah, very fearless, very confident. How did you come up with the title Everything is Horrible and Wonderful?
Because it is. I think that that sums up a lot for me personally. First of all, it was a tweet. Harris was a prolific tweeter, at Twiddles. If you don't know, look it up. He had a tweet. It said, "Let's stop finding a new witch of the week and burning them at the stake. We're all horrible and wonderful and figuring it out." And Harris was the most wonderful person that I've ever known. And he struggled with a horrible disease and died tragically. So there was that. I also, when I was writing the book, I wrote the book in real time the year after he died. And I had a one-year-old. And so I had this beautiful baby who was discovering the world, you know, babies.
Yes.
She, another one. She was like, it's clouds and water and flowers. And so she's discovering these beautiful things. And at the same time, I was really suffering from this terrible grief. And so Wonderful and Horrible kind of summed up that moment.
And what I like about the book is you're very honest about, obviously, how much you loved Harris, how devastating his loss was, but also how hard it is to be close to an addict and how frustrating it is. He told you, was it 3 days before your wedding that he was an addict?
Yeah, not the coolest.
Yeah.
Addicts can be uncool sometimes.
Yeah, that's what you hear that a lot.
You hear that a lot. He really struggled with this addiction. He was in and out of rehab for a year. He went to 3 different rehabs. He tried really hard to beat it. But unfortunately, you know, the stats are true. It's
And something that you hear so much now with stories of how this happens, how people, he was on painkillers. They were too expensive. He started using heroin. What is there anything that you would say to families who have loved ones going through this? Is there, I know it's hard to say there's, obviously, because there's not a playbook, but what would you say to anyone as far as what you learned and what you would want them to know?
It's a tough question because ultimately we lost, you know? I mean, if being smart and funny and talented and the most charming person in any room could win drug addiction, then Harris would still be here. It doesn't matter who you are. That stereotype of a drug addict living under a bridge is not true. It can affect anybody. And there's such a stigma around it. So I feel like if we can get rid of that stigma, I mean, people will tell me all the time, I've written a lot and I've put a lot online, and they'll say, oh my gosh, nobody's talking about this. And you just vocalize something that I've been too ashamed to talk about. Or I feel like if we could just talk about it more and get the judgment out of the conversation, then maybe it would help. I also think that as a society, we just haven't figured out how to address the issue because 30 days in rehab clearly isn't enough. I've heard people say we need to do 6 months in rehab, but that's totally bonkers. Who can take 6 months off?
Yeah.
I can't even take off 3 for having a baby.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's that's like, a big deal.
Did yeah. you know that?
That's a person. Yeah. yeah. You're having a person.
A person, yeah. It's hard.
Harris had an interesting relationship with decorum, did not have a lot of respect for it. And there was a wonderful thing in the book, which is, will you read Harris's reply if I read the first half of the email?
I would be honored.
Okay, great. I feel like this will honor him and his memory. He got an email that went to the entire staff on his show, Parks and Rec, which is the mandatory workplace harassment meeting. And it's a brief reminder. We all have attended a mandatory NBC workplace harassment seminar here at the lot. It will be downstairs in the basement, multi-purpose room number 1. There will be bagels and coffee. Thanks. And then your brother Harris wrote back.
Reply all.
Okay.
2 executives.
Yeah.
Who hire him.
Yeah.
Will the bagels be shaped like holes?
Can't think of a better way to honor his memory than that.
Sums it up.
Thank you so much for writing this book. Thank you for being here. Congratulations on your baby. Such a pleasure to have you. Stephanie Whittles Wax, everybody. Everything is Horrible and Wonderful is available.
Hey, this is Kevin from Late Night. We are here with Stephanie Whittles Wax, who is going to take a few more questions for us backstage. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Kevin.
How's it going?
It's going well.
Good.
I was just on Late Night with Seth Meyers.
You were.
which was surreal.
Yes.
But I'm good. I'm good.
Good. Feel okay about it?
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you for being here. I know this book is the title, Everything is Horrible and Wonderful. It must have been just such an emotional process to write this. Can you walk us through how long it took you to write and the process of actually dealing with this grief and what it took to put this book together?
Yeah, I did not decide to write this book. The book kind of wrote itself. I was in a dark hole. It was like consumed by every horrible emotion at once that you could possibly be consumed by. It was a terrible place to be. And I was just stuck there and I didn't know how to get out. And I kind of started writing it down. It was my daughter was one and she only slept in the car and I would be stuck in the car for 2 to 3 hours at a time. And so I started writing all these thoughts down on my iPhone. And after a while of having all of these notes, my husband suggested that I put them onto an internet and then people would read them, which is something you could do. Who knew? And so I did. And that's how I found my agent who reached out to me and said, do you want to turn this into a book? And at that point, I was writing so much. She said, you know, if at the end of the year you have a book, great. If not, no big deal. And I just threw myself into it. It was like the only thing that I could do to feel, I'm not going to say in control because I didn't feel in control, but it was something I could do to work through it. It was truly a processing thing. I was trying, one, to get out of this dark place, and two, to make sense of this thing that made no sense and to figure out, like, retrace my steps. How did we get here? What happened? How did it happen? Did I do everything I could do? All of these sorts of things. And by the end of the year, we had a book, and now I'm here.
It's just over 3 years since he passed away.
February 19th, it was 3 years.
What was the initial outpouring of support from people online and social media? What was that like to experience?
Well, there's kind of two layers to it. The first was after Harris passed away, because he was a celebrity of sorts. He was a trending topic. There was all of this, you know, I mean, all I saw online was Harris, hashtag Harris Whittles. And it was like simultaneously, I say in the book, horrifying and also very comforting that everyone was paying attention to this thing that I was also exclusively paying attention to. But what happens with trending topics is that they go away. And so once everyone else moved on to the next thing, I was still stuck in this place, like, hey, man, where, guys, like, I'm still sad. How are you able to move on to posting a picture of your dinner or whatever? And so that left me feeling really empty. When I started putting work online and people started responding to that, I hesitate to say that it made me feel better, because nothing could make me feel better, but it made me feel less alone. It made me feel like, you know, I'm not the only person in the world who's experienced this. And somebody gave me The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion, and I read that in the first few months after he died. And I had a similar response, like, oh, thank God somebody else knows what this feels like, because it is like, I feel like I'm going to die of this pain and sorrow. And, you know, the fact, I don't know, there's something about like hearing from strangers online that they know what you're going through that helps you in some way. And it's sort of a similar experience I had with my daughter was born with hearing loss and she wears hearing aids and she's doing great. She's killing it at life, but she's four. But initially when we were dealing with all of that sorrow and grief around that, the only people that made me feel better were people I did not know, strangers who had been through it before, who could be like, it's going to be okay. Like, you're going to be okay. I know you're really scared. So there is this kind of nice aspect to the internet, which is strange to say because it's such a terrible place.
Yep.
It can be so toxic and horrible.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that communal aspect has been really therapeutic for me.
The book jumps around in time. You have stories about how you and Harris were growing up. There's one story that I thought was pretty funny. Your mom put you in charm school.
Yeah. Sorry for her. My mom was and is from Mississippi. Mm-hmm. She is Southern Belle lady. She is dressed to the nines. You know, she's very charming. Everybody is honey sugar darling. She's got a very thick accent. Mm-hmm. And Harris and I were just like monsters, you know, from the start. And both of us were, and had no sense of, you know, being a civilized human being. And so she put us in charm school when we were little. I mean, I feel like we must have been no more than seven, mm-hmm. and which would put Harris at four, you know, mm-hmm. or five, which is the age of my current child. So I'm like, don't know why you thought this was a good idea. Mm-hmm. But we did go through the course. And then at one point they put these water bowls out for you to wash your hands, but we just picked them up and drank out of them like dogs because uh-huh. they seemed like receptacles that held water yeah. that you drank. So we failed yeah. miserably at charm school.
There's also something that you talk about in the book of just going through this tragic loss, but there's also these small moments of levity, like your husband writing Harris's obituary in the paper, and then you receive a bill from the newspaper for, what, like $2,500?
$2,500. Sort of, for words.
Yeah.
This happened very shortly after Harris died. It was in the week after, which was a fog, but a terrible, terrible time, and really nothing but tears and sorrow at that point. And you're really consumed by it. But I remember we got this bill and I stepped out of my grief for a second and I was like, I'm sorry, what? Like, no, we will not pay $2,500 for some words. And then realizing that I was in the middle of the scene from The Big Lebowski where John Goodman's character is yelling at the funeral director about not wanting to pay $180 for an urn and then wanting to use the Folgers coffee can instead right. to transport Donnie, who has just died. And I'm like sitting there through this horribly sorrowful moment being like, what was that line from The Big Lebowski about being bereaved and not being saps? And what, somebody Google that line. And, you know, and like, then we're having a conversation about like The Big Lebowski and John Goodman's character. And I'm like, reenacting that moment. And then we did get the bill down to $1,500 because like, come on.
Yeah.
but then like the great thing is like, you can step right back into feeling like, you know, like right. it's always there. Yeah. So, you know, what happens, I think, when you're grief stricken is that you're still you, you know, you're still like moving through the world in the same way you do. And my family, my people move through the world using humor. And so that doesn't stop. You know, you just kind of like can take a break and make a joke and then come right back
yeah.
to feeling terrible. And that kind of kept happening throughout.
Yeah, I would imagine that's such a tough line to straddle. And
I think it's the thing that keeps you alive, though. I mean, I think it's why Harris was a comedian. It's, you know, it's, there's so much terrible, there's so much horrible, as the title says, yeah. but, you know, if you don't take those moments to laugh, like, we would all be dead because it's hard to be a person. And then when you're going through this kind of thing, it's excruciating. So I feel like it was a survival thing too. We had to climb out of it every once in a while and make a joke.
Yeah.
I mean, I said at one point, I remember really early on, like maybe 3 or 4 days later, I remember screaming to my mother, it's really good that he's dead because if he wasn't, I would f***ing kill him,
yeah.
you know? And it's like, that's not appropriate. Right. But she totally got it. She was yeah. like, I know.
yeah, yeah. It must have been, like I said, incredibly hard to write this. Do you have a favorite memory of Harris, a favorite story that sums him up for you that you would like to share with people?
I think my favorite Harris memory is just, you know, he did a lot of crazy stuff growing up. He was always who he was. He used to put a toothbrush in his butt and draw a face on the butt and then talk out of the butt with the yeah. toothbrush in it. And we all thought it was great and really praised him and yeah. always got a laugh. That joke yeah. always killed in our house. And he must have been like six, you know, but I just, when people ask me like, what do you remember? I just remember this toothbrush thing yeah. so vividly. And, you know, I mean, there's a million memories yeah. with him.
But he followed that and made a career out of it.
He was always who he was and he was always funny and he was always fearless. And, yeah. you know, those are the things that made him incredibly special. And I think also what made him kind of struggle too.
One thing that I think, you know, is sort of an all too common story now is that he had chronic back pain, went to the doctor and was prescribed painkillers. And so that led him down this road of addiction.
Mm-hmm. Such a stupid story.
Yeah.
I hate this story.
Yeah.
It's so cliche now. You know, you hear about this all the time. I don't even understand why doctors are still prescribing this stuff. It seems like the easy thing would be to stop prescribing it. Because when you look at the facts about it and how fast it takes for your brain to become dependent on it, it's horrifying. You know, Harris and I loved television. I still love television. But we would watch that show Intervention. We loved the guy Jeff Van Vonderen. Man, I'm butchering that guy's name. But anyway, he was one of the rehab guys, mm-hmm. the therapist. And we would love him. We quoted him constantly. And then I remember saying to him, like, do you understand that you are an episode of Intervention right now? Like, you know how this story ends. But that's the thing, is that's why it's so tragic. And in the book, I talk a lot about it feeling like a Greek tragedy, mm-hmm. in ways, because the deal with Greek tragedy is like, you know how it's going to end and you can't do anything to stop it. And you're watching this train wreck happen and feeling completely powerless. And so we both knew the storyline, but he couldn't stop. It is truly addictive.
Yeah.
It destroys people. People ask, like, what do you think the answer is? I have no idea. I have no idea. Something has to happen.
Right.
Because 70,000 people died last year.
Well, I think people who are dealing with it or have family members who are dealing with it will get a lot out of reading the book and find some support. And thank you for writing the book and sharing your story and coming on to talk about it.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course.
I love talking about this stuff. It's so uplifting. No, I'm kidding. It's fine.
Yeah.
It sucks, but it's like, it's good to talk about it.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Yeah. Bye.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.